Hello, I'm Norman Wu. This is number 0520, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0520. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Ian Weldon, photographer and author of I'm Not a Wedding Photographer. Did Ian have an aha moment when he started shooting weddings?
Kind of. I started to photograph weddings as a way to make money to work on other documentary projects. And that was about 7 years ago. And what I found quite quickly is I could make the type of photographs that I wanted at weddings. They are really fruitful ground for good photographs. And very quickly, I suppose my commercial need was taken over by an artistic need. And weddings became a project within themselves from that standpoint.
Stephen Paul Leyva, author of Journey to Where, which is a contemporary scientific romance. What exactly is a contemporary scientific romance?
Scientific romance was the term first used for what we now call science fiction in the end of the 19th century, early part of the 20th, with works like H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, Edgar Rice Burroughs. All of those were referred to at the time as a scientific romance. Now, of course, they didn't mean scientists in love. Romance as in an adventure, going from the French term of roman, which meant a novel or a story or a tale. It's more or less the same thing as science fiction, only that was the term that was used then. And this novel is basically inspired by that.
Stuart Nallman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nallman, and Book Banter wants to know if you remember your first summer job. Well, Bill Geist does, and he chronicles it all, odd jobs and the characters, in Lake of the Ozarks. So it's time to collect that hard-earned pocket money very shortly on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0520, was Norman Wu, an old friend from my Dawson College days. Thank you very much, Norman, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? According to 81-year-old Jerry Danford of Zifferellis, Florida, it was a coordinated attack. One attacker would approach, and when I was fighting that one off, the other one would come at me. He came out of the attack with a broken hip and slashes to his head. But it wasn't a band of criminals that were attacking the man. The culprits were wild turkeys. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission officers have come to the retirement community at least twice so far. According to their reports, residents recounted turkeys in front yards, prohibiting people from exiting dwellings, residents having to run to cars or into homes as turkeys approached, and turkeys chasing vehicles and golf carts. FWC ruled the turkeys must be left alone until hunting season, at which point they can be trapped or killed. So let me get this straight. For the traumatized retirees, there is a short window of opportunity when it comes to hunting down these wild turkeys. But for the wild turkeys, it's retiree hunting season year-round. Yeah. A police constable in London, England, was assigned to guard a home where a child had been killed. 44-year-old Constable Avi Maharaj was apparently bored with his assignment before the body was even removed. Maharaj passed the time by watching the family's TV and ordering adult entertainment using the family's account. Maharaj pleaded guilty to fraud after ordering 4 pay-per-view videos and once sentenced will then have to face police misconduct hearings. The illicit charges were discovered by the family, who found 26 pounds, or about $32.50 worth of videos that were charged to their Virgin TV account while they were out of the house during the time Maharaj was guarding it. Although, truth be told, there probably weren't any virgins in the videos. Exactly how did he think he wasn't going to get caught? I mean, that level of moron is truly special. Steve Ferguson of New Port Richey, Florida, got an alert from his home security camera system of activity at his house while he was away. He logged in and saw a man trying to get in through a door, then gaining entry by breaking a window. Ferguson quickly called the sheriff and described not only the man but his getaway vehicle, a brown horse. "Who takes a getaway horse to a robbery?" Ferguson asked later. When deputies arrived, the intruder came out to ask them if they had seen his horse, called Angel, because it had wandered off while he was inside. The horse was found nearby. 52-year-old Lonnie Maddox, who is known by the street name The Rooster, was arrested for burglary, and investigators note that he has a long criminal history. In other words, his horse may be known as Angel, but he isn't. Do you think if the police had to chase him down, they would have to cut him off at the pass? Yeah, I know. I watched a lot of Westerns as a kid. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, it is true that love is a battlefield, especially in Pennsylvania, where naked women run around the street stabbing each other. Allegheny County Housing Authority police were trying to identify a naked woman who allegedly slashed or stabbed three other women in an apparent lover's quarrel at a public housing complex. Police did not immediately release the names of any of the other women involved in the incident. Chief Mike Vogel said one woman accompanied by one friend and another woman accompanied by two others clashed in the street. Sort of like a lesbian West Side Story.
I feel pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and gay.
That is when the naked woman became involved, dashing into the fray out of nowhere like a psychotic Zorro, swinging like crazy and whipping her knife around too.
She's in love, she thinks she can say
la la la.
She isn't in love, she's merely insane.
Police planned to charge the five women who met to fight, as well as the naked woman, though none of the other women would identify her.
Modest and pure, polite and refined.
La la la.
Well-bred and mature, and out of her mind.
Two women were treated at hospitals for stab or slash wounds. Ain't love grand? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ian Weldon is a British photographer who does weddings. So why does he have an exhibit and a book called I Am Not a Wedding Photographer? Because the types of wedding shots that Ian takes aren't necessarily the conventional ones. Ian joins us via Skype from Durham in Northern England to talk about his unique style and his book. Hi, Ian.
Hello. How's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
No problem.
Is this something, did you have an aha moment as a photographer when you said, I'm not going to do the traditional wedding pictures?
Kind of. I started to photograph weddings as a way to make money to work on other documentary projects. And that was about 7 years ago. And what I found quite quickly is I could make the type of photographs that I wanted at weddings. They are really fruitful ground for good photographs. And very quickly, I suppose my commercial need was taken over by an artistic need, and weddings became a project within themselves from that standpoint. Hmm.
I get the feeling that you may have come across this way of doing wedding photography at the right time. And the reason why I say that is I think traditionally weddings have been the purview of the parents of the bride or the parents mm-hmm. of the groom. And that's mm-hmm. why people end up inviting people to their wedding that they don't even know or want, because parents and family kind of dictate how things are to go. And that may also involve the wedding pictures as well. But now it seems to be weddings are more about the personalities of the people who are getting married, and their pictures are dictating that.
Well, as a documentary photographer, I feel that that's the way that it should be. I suppose that weddings have been approached in a more documentary style for quite some time now, but I think that the photographers still pander somewhat to industry expectation, not necessarily parental expectation. And I don't know, things are changing. People are doing their own things, and people want that reality conveyed rather than a contrived idea of what the photographer or an industry thinks it should look like.
Is there a balance in what you do? Do some people say, well, gee, you know, I want some of those traditional wedding pictures, and then you can do whatever you want? Or or do you have carte blanche to do what you think is best in the situation?
Well, I think that people hire me and trust me to capture the personality of the day. But I am there all day, and there is still expectation from parents that Auntie Mary will have a picture beside Uncle Bob, or family members who maybe haven't seen each other for a long time and won't see each other for a long time afterwards. And yeah, I'm there all day. It would be quite ignorant of me to say, no, I am not going to take a picture of people together. And bride and groom portraits, it's not something that I don't do. I just haven't focused my attention on making that perfect and pretty. I've focused my attention on photography. So if people want the more traditional style and they want pretty well-lit, perfect portraits, then there are people out there who are way better at doing that than I am. I'm just offering a different perspective, I think.
And we should mention to folks, people can go to your website, which is ianweldon.com, and actually see some of the photos that we're talking about and get an idea of the type of pictures you capture, which are absolutely amazing, I might say.
Well, thank you.
I would assume that now that you've been doing this for several years, that you have a bit of a reputation and people hire you because of what you do and how you do it. Was it different when you started doing it? Was there any pushback?
I think because it was kind of a natural progression, really. I didn't one day just decide that, right, I'm going to do it like this because I don't want to do it the way that the industry expects. At the time that I started, I was really getting interested in photography history, and I started to apply the ideas of what I thought photography was to wedding photography. So it just kind of phased out. But I don't know, are things different? I mean, I think differently as far as what I'm trying to do. So the situation, yeah, it is different. I'm obviously attracting people who want what it is that I do, which I suppose for any artist is a great place to be.
You know, when I first saw the piece about you, I saw a piece on you on the BBC, as a matter of fact, a little while ago. And when I first saw the piece about you, I thought, I don't know how this will go over with a lot of people, the idea of doing wedding shots the way you do it. But the more I thought about it, the thing that I found interesting is, even if you don't know the couple involved in the wedding, when I see the pictures you do, I get a sense of their personality, which you normally do not get in wedding pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm going to capture. Well, I'm not going to a wedding with any preconceived idea of how I think it should look. I'm approaching it as a photographer to find those personalities. So if I was going and with an idea of specific shots that I wanted, then that's where my focus would be rather than the people in the situation. And I just sort of immerse myself in the situation and be part of it, you know, like go along with it. And I think that's how I can get not just physically closer, but emotionally closer to the subject as well.
Tell us about how you took this one step further and you now have a book. You first of all had an exhibit and you have a book called I Am Not a Wedding Photographer.
Yes.
Tell us about
I think, I Am Not a Wedding Photographer. It just came about because I was trying to explain to people that I did shoot weddings, but I wasn't a wedding photographer, or not the kind of wedding photographer that we all perceive. And that perception is quite accurate in most cases. So I've been working on this this way of shooting and this idea of shooting for 7 years, and eventually it catches the eye of Martin Parr, which for me is the greatest of compliments, because Martin not only 8 years ago or so, not only changed the way that I perceived photography, but that in turn changed who I was as a human being. Hmm. So to have him recognize that, like 8 years later, and offer me a show in his gallery and co-publish a book of the work with RRB Photo Books, as I say, it's the greatest of compliment, man. Okay. You know, it's like it just came about because somebody had mentioned my name to him. He had a look and, hey, he liked it.
Have you heard from any of the people whose pictures you have taken that are included in the exhibit in the book? What are their thoughts?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm from the start, I'm not trying to hoodwink anybody into I'm not telling them I'm doing one thing and then doing something else. And they're all in on it. And when we had the opening at the Martin Parr Foundation a couple of weeks ago, a couple of the couples were actually there.
What was that like for you?
That was great. I mean, because of the way that I shoot and the people who hire me, we have to really have they get what I'm doing, so we have some kind of connection. So a lot of the couples that I work with, we do stay in touch. So it was nice to have them there, and it was nice to having me take a picture of them in front of their picture in the gallery.
You know, as I said earlier, as someone who doesn't know the subjects you worked with, and I look at the pictures, I get a sense of their personality. It must be even more exciting and exhilarating. I mean, it's only 7 years since you started doing this, but I can imagine 20, 30 years down the road, people looking back at the pictures of a particular wedding and having extremely fond memories of the event because of the way you captured it.
That's what I hope, and that's what I'm going for. Even with the other longer-term projects that I work on, I see those. Making those photographs now is important, but I don't think those photographs will be. People won't understand how important they are until 20 or 30 years down the line. When we have a document, not just, especially the couples that I work for, we have a document of their wedding, but future generations from the work that I'm doing in the body of work also have this look at weddings in our time, this document of weddings in our time.
Two pictures come to mind, and again, people can go to your website and take a look at them. There's one of them of a child making a funny face, which is always interesting at a wedding.
Yeah.
And there's another one of a couple really kissing behind the people who are taking a picture of.
And really going for it.
Really going for it. And I always imagine what that picture will be in the minds of those who are involved in the wedding and that couple years from now when they look at it later.
Yeah. Well, hey, do you know what? That's what happened. And that's what I'm there to capture. I'm there to capture the reality and the things that happened on the day. But the last photograph that you mentioned was one of the first photographs that I made where I realized that the wedding was more than just the bride and groom. There was stuff going on outside of that. And if I just focused on the bride and groom, then I would have pictures of the same two people in different places during the day. And that wasn't really telling any kind of story.
You do realize the irony of all this, and that is you could probably go down in history as one of the best wedding photographers ever, and you have a book called I Am Not a Wedding Photographer.
It's great. It's perfect. It is. I suppose that's the duality that I'm trying to create with all of the work that I do. It's an utterly serious situation, but it's also utterly ridiculous at exactly the same time.
As I said, I saw your story on the BBC. When I did some searching online, I found other places that had done interviews with you. What kind of attention are you gathering and gaining outside of Britain for the work that you've done?
A lot. CNN have picked it up. I think Good Morning America today wanted something. Vanity Fair in Italy, Spiegel, Germany. Neon France, Vice ID France, who called me the coolest wedding photographer in the world. I'll take that. Thank you very much. It's just obviously we had PR and press release and images for the exhibition and the book, but it really has gone like wildfire. It's gone viral, I would say. And that's great. I like that people are liking the work.
It's an amazing book. It's a great exhibit. It's a great idea, and I wouldn't be surprised. You know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. I wouldn't be surprised if many wedding photographers start using the Weldon approach. You might become a verb when it comes to wedding photography.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I think because of the way that the photographs look, people perceive it as somewhat amateurish, and people also see that it's easily replicatable. But because of my approach, and like for me, the photographs are just the consequence of my process. That's the photographs aren't the goal. So I apply the idea to a wedding, and these photographs are what comes out the other end of it. So it's, I get what you're saying as far as people can see it as some sort of marketing angle, which the wedding industry does quite a lot. But I think the way that I make pictures is completely unique to me. So they'll just be kind of copies, and they don't quite get the point.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Well, I think it makes absolute sense. You stay unique. The book is I Am Not a Wedding Photographer. Ian, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much for having me on, man.
Photographer Ian Weldon. Again, his book is called I Am Not a Wedding Photographer. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0520, and you'll find links to Ian's site, where you can see some of his excellent work on display. Plus, at our site, you'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll speak to the author of Journey to Where. Plus, Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. We have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcast and Apple Podcast. Just click on the Google Podcast or Apple Podcast button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Now, let's get back to the stuff. More Washington State spas are coming forward to police in the town of Kirkland in the search for a woman dubbed as the Botox Bandit, who is suspected in an alleged scheme to receive spa treatments and slip away without paying. Also known as the face filler fraudster, the woman is accused of owing up to $2,000 for Botox treatments from a skincare clinic. She had an appointment on July 5th at the Derma Vita Skincare Clinic, where she allegedly told the clinic staff she forgot her wallet in the car and then left and never returned to pay her bill. But now police in Kirkland and Bellevue say the 30-year-old woman has hit three other spas since last November. Wow. Is she a hardened criminal or is it just her face? The woman, who is 30-year-old Lauren L. Clavano, is still on the loose. You know, when they do catch her, and they will, and they want to take her mugshot, they're going to have to tell her not to smile for the picture. Well, actually, I think that part is just a given. Wasatch Brewery in Salt Lake City, Utah, won't be able to sell two of its brews in North Carolina after the state's Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission rejected the beer's names, Polygamy Porter and Polygamy Nitro Porter. The names poke fun at the historical polygamous marriages that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints practiced until the 1890s. But as the commission explained in a letter, polygamy is illegal. Therefore, these products will not be approved. The rejection surprised the brewery. We were not expecting it, especially because we've been making this beer now for 18 years, said brewmaster John Lee. The brewery is appealing the decision so they can add Polygamy Porter with the slogans, Why Have Just One, and Take Some Home to the Wives, and Nitro Polygamy Porter with its slogan, Meet the Sister Wife of Our Classic Brew, to the list of 20 beers they already sell in North Carolina. You know, it's not like you can enjoy multiple beers at the same time. But seriously, North Carolina really needs to get off their high horse. If this beer has been sold for 18 years in Utah, where polygamy is a word spoken in hushed tones, then North Carolina should be able to see the joke for what it is and get with the program. In other words, they shouldn't be forcing Wasatch Brewery to hold their beer. Yeah. Speaking of which, the Johnson County, Iowa Sheriff's Office received a report of a reckless driver near Iowa City driving over 100 miles per hour and forcing cars off the road. Deputies didn't get there in time. Witnesses say the Chevrolet C1500 pickup sideswiped a semi-truck and crashed into a ditch. Amazingly, the driver was not injured. He managed to get out of the truck and stagger back to the roadway, still holding his can of beer. 31-year-old David Alexander Axnix was arrested and charged with driving while intoxicated, failure to maintain control, failure to provide proof of insurance, and driving without a valid driver's license, because in these stories, they never have a valid driver's license. You know, hold my beer and watch this means you don't get to hold it yourself. Start over, pal. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman was busted in Massachusetts for drunk driving after cops found her driving with a gas pump nozzle attached to her Range Rover. Drunk drivers always think they can drive fine, police in Wilmington posted on Facebook. In addition to her inability to stay in her own traffic lane, there was something else about her vehicle that caught other motorists' attention. Authorities in Middlesex County identified the woman as 24-year-old Alicia Esquilan of Hudson, New Hampshire. She was arraigned on charges of operating under the influence of liquor, negligent operations of a motor vehicle, and an open container violation. Well, at least she had a valid license. Police said that the gas nozzle was later returned to its rightful owner, a gas station about 6 miles away. Gee, do you think she paid for the gas before she left? Yeah, anyway. You see, this is why I believe we've all been on a slippery slope ever since they brought in self-serve gas stations. Bring back full service, I say.
You can trust your car to the man who wears the star. The big, bright Texaco Star.
Yeah, those were the good old days, right after we got rid of those buggy whips. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Stephen Paul Leyva has been on the show several times. He's a good friend in California. He's here to talk about his latest book. It's billed as a contemporary scientific romance. It's called Journey to Where. And Steve is on the line, as I just said, from California to tell us all about it. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks once again for being on the program. So what exactly is a contemporary scientific romance?
Well, I seem to have confused a few people with that, haven't I? Scientific romance was the term first used for what we now call science fiction in the end of the 19th century, early part of the 20th, with works like H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and even Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. He had a character called Professor Challenger, and the famous novel with that character was The Lost World. All of those were referred to at the time as a scientific romance. Now, of course, they didn't mean scientists in love, romance as in an adventure, going from the, you know, the Latin term of, or the French term of roman, which meant a novel or a story or a tale. So it more or less the same thing as science fiction, only that was the term that was used then. And this novel is basically inspired by that. And I wanted to write something, harken back to those kind of novels without doing a pastiche, without trying to recreate that. So it's a contemporary novel, but it has that sense of adventure. Basically, things that happened where scientists or adventurers wind up in a strange lost world, as in Conan Doyle's book, or in H.G. Wells' The Time Machine in the future, or Edgar Rice Burroughs get transported to Mars. and then they have to deal with being in this strange world. So that's basically what I'm trying to do.
Would it be safe to say that this story deals with sort of a parallel universe?
Yes, although it starts with the four scientists, of course, who are doing an experiment. And they're doing an experiment on time. Now, the lead scientist, Sam Reynolds, has a theory. And by the way, like in scientific romances, this is not hard science. It's more fanciful science. But he has a theory that there's an element of time that he calls chrono. There's actually something about the physical universe that is time itself, something akin to the space-time fabric of space, as Einstein put it. But he's looking for an element. So in a huge super collider, much larger than the one in CERN, this starts about maybe 20, 30 years in our future. He's gotten the right to have an evening to use this accelerator to test his theory. But what happens is there's an accident. It's an accident caused by someone who's a bit jealous. And they hit the button. They start the accelerator. They lose consciousness. They wake up 3 days later. Everything in the this accelerator, by the way, is in the middle of the Mojave Desert here in the United States. And it's, like I say, huge. They wake up. They go up out of the accelerator, and they find that, as you know, these accelerators are a big circle, right?
Right.
They find that everything within this circle looks like the Mojave Desert, but everything outside of it is this lush forest. And suddenly some dinosaurs walk by. So they are first assumed, somehow, they turn this accelerator into a time machine. But once after they've been chased by one of these dinosaurs, and the dinosaur suddenly has to suffer literally slings and arrows coming at them, they realize that there's intelligent bipedal dinosaurs in this world. So it's obviously not a time machine. So have they gone to a parallel universe? Or later they theorize possibly whatever they did in the experiment broke down their universe and rebuild it as this universe. They don't quite know exactly what happened, but they're stuck in this world as the only Homo sapiens, because there are the mammals. This is a world where the asteroid did not hit the Earth 65, 66 million years ago. So mammals never had a chance to evolve into, eventually, some of us, Homo sapiens. But dinosaurs did. And there's two species of them, the scales and the downies. So there's reptilian dinosaurs that eventually somehow evolved into creatively intelligent bipeds, but there's also the dinosaurs that were more bird-like. That species also evolved into creatively intelligent dinosaurs.
Now, you mentioned that there was a scientist who sabotaged this whole thing, and that's how this thing started out. Would this be similar to, say, oh, I don't know, Dr. Zachary Smith from Lost in Space?
Yeah, I would say so, actually. The head of this super collider, which is called the Dark Lady, because part of what they're looking into is dark matter and dark energy. He was once the best friend of the lead scientist. And they were both mentored by another scientist on the team at MIT. And they were both brilliant. But Sam, our lead scientist, was just a little bit more brilliant. So this guy, Bertrand Brill, who's the head of the accelerator, is jealous. But he's also a political creature. But being a political creature, he managed to get the government to fund this accelerator, which, if you know the history, we tried to have a super collider in this country. And it was killed by the government, and it never happened. So the big one in CERN is now the big one in all this. So he does something, let's just say, which causes this problem to happen. And, of course, the four other scientists never realized this during most of the novel, that he's the one that caused it. But they're all stuck in this universe and have to be together.
With most authors, it's always a way to, whatever story they're writing, be it science fiction or drama or whatever, it's always seems to be about the human condition. Without giving away the ending or anything about this story, was there something you were trying to tell us about man or his survival or his co-working with others or mending fences with enemies or whatever? Is there something you're trying to tell us beneath your plot line in the story?
Yeah, all novels are really, if they're good, they're about the human condition. In these scientific romances of the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, my favorite is H.G. Wells, because he used his work to talk about social issues he was very concerned about. As you may know, he was a socialist, a member of the Fabian Society, and for example, in The Time Machine, what he's really talking about is not whether there's the possibility of traveling in time, but what's going to happen if the divide between the haves and the have-nots continue. So he's really talking about social issues and projecting that way. I use this in the same way, and besides a big adventure, and I hope an exciting adventure and a little bit of humor, it also portrays a society that is autocratic. It makes the assumption that the dinosaurs became creatively intelligent millions of years ago or hundreds of thousands of years ago instead of just thousands of years ago. And they've had a number of civilizations, some of which, if you could see them as they were, we would consider futuristic. And in fact, they come across a ruined city that, if it had not been ruined, would certainly be well advanced of what we have now. But at this time, they are in a dark age. And the particular land that this is, which is called a Nariquan, is ruled by the Great Quan. And he's an autocratic ruler. There's no parliament. He runs everything. And he runs it basically for the elite. And then everybody else who he designates to be slaves, who are called yellow sacks because they wear sort of a yellow sack-like garment, support and have to attend to and service the elite. And the Great Quan lives in literally a shining city on the hill. It's shining because the outside of this walled city is covered with beaded gold sheets. So it shines in the sunlight. And that's where all the elite live, serviced by the yellow sack. And our lead characters are thrown into this society. And there's a moral dilemma because the lead scientist would like to somehow figure out what went wrong, recreate the experiment, or double back and maybe try to recover his universe or get back. But this is a dark age world, supposedly with no source of artificial energy. How is he going to do that?
And that's where we'll leave
part of the problem.
And that's where we'll leave the reader, because hopefully they'll pick it up. Now, this book is available online as an ebook, right?
It's an ebook and a print book. Both.
Both.
Yeah, you can get it. It's online at obviously Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google Play, Kobo, all of the online booksellers. In both ebook and in trade paperback.
Excellent. And the book is called Journey to Where. Steve, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, Peter. I always have a good time.
Author Stephen Paul Leyva. His new novel is Journey to Where. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0520, and you'll find links to Steve's blog, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here with the gist of the story, or should we say the geist of the story, is Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. You're resorting to puns again, aren't you?
Yes, yes, I am.
So to speak. you chide me on my singing. I'm going to have to chide you on your use of puns.
Yes. Touche. Touche.
Touche. Yeah, well, all right. So that's that. I got it out of my system. Because on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a book by Bill Geist, who's a well-known humorist and journalist and what have you. And we're going to talk about summer jobs in particular.
And when we say Bill Geist, not to be confused with Willie Geist, who is his son, who was on the Today Show.
That's right, who's doing carving quite a reputation for himself in the in the journalism world. So, and father, like son.
And also on Morning Joe.
Uh-huh. No, he's quite the chip off the old Geist flock. I mean,
yes.
You know what I mean.
Yep.
So, as I was saying, summer job. Practically a rite of passage for teenagers who outgrew summer camp and would work anywhere in order to make some extra bucks for themselves. And their first summer jobs hold a special place in their collective memories about their baptismal fire into the working world. Now, personally speaking, Peter, that rite of passage came to me in the summer of 1976 because I worked three separate jobs that summer. One of them was a brief stint as a sandwich board wearing human billboard trolling St. Catherine Street West in downtown Montreal to promote a sale at the old 2020 University Mall, which was an underground mall, the weekend before the 1976 Olympics started. Well, interesting job.
I can top that.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I was always working as a theater usher and a movie projectionist, but I was also working at the 1976 Summer Games.
Oh, yeah? What were you doing there?
I was selling souvenirs at Molson Stadium where field hockey was played.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
And put it this way, did a lot of people buy a lot of souvenirs from you?
Yes, yes. And we made commission, too, so...
That's some...
And as you can pretty well guess, souvenirs at something like the Olympics, they're not cheap.
No, even in 1976 dollars, huh?
No. The for instance, since you're into books, the album, the Olympic album, nice big coffee table red album that came out for that year.
Oh yes,
which of course I have a copy of. $40 in 1976.
You might as well be paying like $150 today.
Exactly. So if I could sell one of those in the stands, I was doing well.
And I bet you did.
Oh, yeah. But again, back to Bill.
Yeah, back to Bill. He's waiting very patiently right now.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Geist, as we said before, best-selling author and veteran correspondent for the CBS News Sunday Morning program. He spent most of his youthful formative years, most of the 1960s, working a variety of duties ranging from cesspool manager to bellhop for the 41-room Arrowhead Lodge in the Lake of the Ozarks region of Missouri. So this place was owned and operated by his Uncle Ed, who was a hard-drinking, bombastic, tough-as-nails World War II veteran with the Signal Corps. And Geist experienced his summertime rite of passage working in a family-oriented vacation hotel. A time before Holiday Inns really came into vogue. In which an air of tackiness and eccentricity were the order of the day every summer that he worked there. But no matter how many unusual situations and eccentric characters he encountered, Geist has an acute fondness and sense of nostalgia for being part of this vanishing aspect of the family road trip in the American heartland, and he brings it back to great effect in his latest book, the highly entertaining Lake of the Ozarks. Now, reading this book is like a combination of Dirty Dancing and Meatballs. His book is a catalog of fun memories and outrageous incidents that will make you wonder why you decided to spend so many formative summers over in the Lake of the Ozarks.
So what you're saying is Dirty Meatballs.
Dirty Meatballs. I bet you he had the time of his life. But, like, for example, there was this 75-year-old guy named Jim McTeague, who was the overnight desk clerk, who, according to Geist, would, and I quote, sit behind the front desk for about an hour, doing nothing, then move to a comfortable chair nearby where he would continue to do nothing until he dozed off. And then there's the chapters about the lodge's hard-drinking Chef Glenn and his wily kitchen assistant, Annie Hicks, who responded to every situation with her catchphrase, S-fire. And you can guess what the S means. And these chapters, believe me, Peter, will have you laughing literally until your sides ache.
Hmm.
Yeah. But no matter about the eccentric nature that surrounded the Arrowhead Lodge and its motley crew of employees, Geist credited his time there as a means of how it formed his writing and journalistic skills that ended up with an award-winning career for him. Because what he did was, for the Lodge newsletter, he would do these little poems, not like haiku, that would spoof or satirize the times and the people at Arrowhead Lodge. So basically, help build his career.
Sounds like something that would make either a good film or maybe even a better play.
Oh, maybe. Or something that you'll see on Netflix.
Yeah.
Uncensored. But Lake of the Ozarks will have you laughing and reminiscing about how your early summer job experiences, whether it be at a hotel, a store, a warehouse, or a camp, or the 76 Olympics, for that matter, was just as fulfilling for one's personal and professional development as it was for one's wallet.
And again, the book is?
It's called Lake of the Ozarks by Bill Geist. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's $34.
And in a similar vein, what do you suggest?
Well, let's go with, if we're going to go with Bill Geist, let's go for his first book called Little League Confidential, which was a behind-the-scenes expose of, well, Geist was a manager of a Little League team, and what really goes on during those Little League games. So that book really brought him to the forefront. And also, if you're talking about spending a summer or, exploring a vanishing part of Americana, try Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods, in which he did the impossible of actually walking the entire Appalachian Trail from Maine to Georgia.
Mm.
Great book.
And without the benefit of an Argentinian mistress.
Exactly.
Okay, again, this week's book is?
It's called Lake of the Ozarks by Bill Geist, published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's $34.
And how will people find you, sir?
Well, they're not going to find me somewhere deep in the Ozarks at some wacky pre-holiday and resort hotel, especially with Chef Glenn and Annie Hicks. It's going to be in the pages of the Montreal Times every Saturday in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And you're welcome, Peter. And Chef Glenn, watch that meat cleaver. Put it down now.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and a few more Stuff File news stories here on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A 65-year-old Serbian man confessed in court to calling in a false bomb threat to stop a Lufthansa flight attendant from leaving the country because he'd hoped she would go on a date with him. 130 passengers and 5 crew members were evacuated from the flight before its takeoff en route from Belgrade to Frankfurt. The plane was removed from the runway so a special police squad could search it. A spokesman for the prosecutor told Serbian media the prosecution had asked the court to keep the man in custody pending charges of causing panic and disorder. The man told the court he had met 2 flight attendants and invited them for dinner, but they refused. He especially liked one of them, and after he failed to locate her at her hotel, he made one last desperate attempt to keep her from leaving by phoning in a bomb threat. The police traced the call, and the man was arrested a day later. He's 65! Just think what kind of brazen pain in the ass he must have been when he was in his 30s. Hey, pal, no means no. Meanwhile, in Turkey's new Istanbul airport, a first-time flyer had to be rescued on July 10th after she assumed the conveyor belt carrying luggage to the baggage sorting room was her path to the plane. The unnamed woman, juggling a carry-on and a shopping bag, stepped carefully up to the moving belt at the airport check-in and tried to climb on, but lost her balance and took a tumble. Airport personnel were quick to stop the conveyor belt and help her off. No, my dear, people aren't traveling as cargo yet. But depending on the airline, they're still traveling like cattle. Well, this is a story that we seem to be seeing more of these days. A man who wanted to remove weeds made more of a mess than he cleared. At about 5:15 p.m. on July 31st, firefighters received a call of a shed fire in University Mobile Estates. A man who was using a blowtorch to clear weeds near the shed had set it on fire, and the fire spread to other trailer homes in the park. It took firefighters about 20 minutes to get the fire out, but a propane tank leak that lasted about 3 hours caused the department to evacuate everyone in the trailer park. 3 trailer homes were damaged in the fire, with 2 having severe damage and another moderately damaged. The residents of those 3 homes, which included the man who was using the blowtorch, were displaced and are being assisted by the American Red Cross. You know, high school science classes explained so much, but some people never bothered to pay attention. I was seriously considering the idea of making this guy the idiot of the day, but I didn't. But boys and girls, this is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present the idiot of the day.
An Ohio man was arrested after allegedly using a note with his name and address on it during a bank robbery. Michael Harrell walked into a U.S. bank in Cleveland and passed a demand note to a teller. The note said, "This is a robbery. Don't get nobody hurt." Okay, normally I would pause here to rake this guy over the coals because of his sentence structure, but frankly, he's got deeper issues. You see, the note was written on a form Harrell had used at the Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles, which had his name and address on it. Making things even easier for investigators, Harrell made no attempt to hide his face, and it's a bank he had frequently come into, said Sergeant Jennifer Chiacha, spokeswoman for the Cleveland Division of Police. "We've had individuals drop things on the way out the door that they didn't intend to, obviously. We've had individuals drop cell phones that have all their identifying information in it. When you present a note that has your name already on it and address, it helps law enforcement tremendously." Yeah, you already know where I'm going here, aren't you? But I have to ask, why, oh why, would you walk into a bank you regularly visit and without the benefit of any kind of disguise and hand over a robbery note written on a piece of paper that has your name and address on it? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0520. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0520. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.